So this is the second in our series on spiritual death. Badra introduced the subject very beautifully and very powerfully last week of spiritual death. And I'm going to be following on tonight. The actual sort of official title is Dissolving the Illusion of Control. But I'm going to subtitle it We Can't Fix Samsara. That's where I'm going to start, okay? And I'm actually going to start with some verses which I recite every day before I meditate. And I recite these verses there because they're a kind of reminder about why I'm doing what I'm doing as a Buddhist. And they're rather beautiful, actually. I find them quite helpful. I wonder what you'll make of them. And in the middle of the verse, there's a line which is very pertinent to what I'm going to be talking about this evening. So this is the verse. And what I'd like you to do is let's just do it in call and response. Just see how it lands with you, so you enjoy it too. There's something about reciting poetry, I think, which is very strong. Okay, so if you're up for that, all right. So the verse goes like this. This human life is precious.
This human life is precious.
An opportunity to awaken.
An opportunity to awaken.
But this body is impermanent.
But this body is impermanent.
Ready or not, one day I shall die.
Ready or not, one day I shall die.
So this life I must know.
So this life I must know.
As the tiny splash of a raindrop.
As the tiny splash of a raindrop.
A thing of beauty that disappears.
A thing of beauty that disappears.
Even as it comes into being.
Even as it comes into being.
The karma I create shapes the course of my life.
The karma I create shapes the course of my life.
But however I act, life will always have difficulties.
But however I act, life will always have difficulties.
No one can control it all.
No one can control it all.
Only the Dharma can free me and others from suffering forever.
Only the Dharma can free me and others from suffering forever.
Therefore I recall my heart's longing for freedom.
Therefore I recall my heart's longing for freedom.
And resolve to make use of every day and night to realise it.
And resolve to make use of every day and night to realise it.
They're rather beautiful, aren't they? So in the middle there's this line. The karma I create shapes the course of my life. But however I act, life always has difficulties. No one can control it all. And that's the subject for tonight. Dissolving the illusion of control. So it's not an introduction to the magic circle and David Copperfield's mysterious methods. But there will be mystery and there will be magic. So what is this illusion of control? Control of what? And why is it an illusion? So I thought first I'd talk a little bit about something that happened to me very recently, which I think gives an example of how this can manifest in our lives. So as a result of a rather strange combination of events, I've ended up with lots and lots of friends who are scientists and not Buddhists. And given my own personal inclination towards magic and mystery and poetry, I've always been a bit mystified as to why I've ended up with partners, children and friends who are scientists. And I have to say, scientists mostly of the very sceptical about religion variety, of whom I'm extremely fond. And we often discuss or even Barney. Anyway, recently I was at dinner with two of them. One of them's a cell biologist, and the other one is a zoologist and an ecologist, both very successful, clever guys. And they were talking about health. So John has recently been through a real storm. He's had prostate cancer, a heart operation. Both of them have recently lost people very close to them in their lives, a brother and a wife. And the conversation was initially sort of revolving around the suddenness of these events and the shock and the grief of it. But then, very interestingly, the conversation sort of moved on to how to deal with illness when it happens, into a sort of much more pragmatic, much more practical way. And very much about what could have been done in the past and what should be done in the future. And there was this long list of things, how to avoid these things, basically, followed by another long list of cures and treatments about which they know a great deal. Chief among which was lots and lots of talk about the importance of eating well and exercise, you know, subjects which occupy us all. And while I was listening to them, I was suddenly struck by, this thought. They're talking about how to be in control instead of being swept away by their losses and their suffering. It was a very upbeat, you know, conversation. They're trying to set up strategies to deal with events which they have found catastrophic in their lives. They're actually sort of brainstorming, if you like, avoidance methods. This is one way of looking at it. This is what I'm going to be talking about next week, isn't it? I'm witnessing people talking about how to control things. Anyway, at one point, they were very deep in their discussion about superfoods, and they sort of noticed that I wasn't joining in, and they asked me what I thought. And I kind of sort of took a breath, and I started up about how I thought there was far more to understanding the connection between minds and bodies and health than we usually took account of. You know, I said it wasn't just about food. It was about the connection between spirituality and our physical health, you know, things that I'm very interested in. And also, I said, you know, the inevitability of sickness and death, and how we, at our stage of life, in our early 60s, have to start to evolve ways of accepting the inevitability of what's happening around us. And then I said that I thought that our society had a kind of inbuilt scientific materialist view, at which point they went, that we can avoid them, or at the very least we can delay them significantly. We often react with sort of disbelief and shock when people die. A couple of years ago, my ex-husband, Pete, died very, very suddenly of a heart attack. He'd been very fit, very well, very active, no sign of illness. He got up to make a cup of tea one morning and dropped dead. It was very shocking and tragic. But soon after, a friend came round to visit me, Leslie, and she was, of course, very shocked. But she said something that has remained with me. She said, "I can't understand it. I just can't understand it. I mean, he ate well." Anyway, at the end of this, my two very well-informed and very much loved friends sort of looked at me blankly and then went straight back to their conversation about the benefits of low alcohol and Fitbits. They weren't really interested in my take at all. Not really. And, you know, let's face it, who wants to talk about death and facing it? They certainly didn't want to on that occasion. They're quite normal, of course, but they're not Buddhist. And anyway, it's not that these things aren't important, healthy lifestyle and so forth aren't important. Of course they're important. It's the underlying view which I witness again and again and again, that if I do it right, I'll be all right. In other words, at a very simple level, if I eat right, if I exercise right, if I sleep right and I relax okay, I'll be okay, yeah? And then more, if I have the right job, if I have the right relationship, if I have the right social life, then I'll be okay. In other words, if I do the right things, then I can fix samsara. Samsara being our relative human existence, the one that we're all in. I can be continually, maybe happy, at the very least comfortable. Now, I would hazard a guess, probably not a very comfortable one for some of us, that this frequently can carry over into our spiritual lives as well. When we get religious, I think that for many of us, and certainly myself, there is still this deep conviction that although I discovered that the materialist life doesn't bring me lasting contentment, I don't actually want to give it up very much, or give up very much of it. And even more importantly, that deep down there's a view that if I have the right beliefs, if I have the right philosophy, if I do the right things in my meditation practice, my ethics practice, if I'm nice and I cultivate compassion, if I meditate enough, it'll be okay. You know, that I'll be okay. Things will get better for me. The Buddha will tell me again and again that it won't. My teachers will tell me again and again the first noble truth of dukkha, that human life as we know it is fundamentally unsatisfactory because of how we relate to it. But I still don't fully believe it in my heart. Somewhere in there, I think I cling to this hope that it's all going to feel better soon. And I believe that at a deep level, if I do things right, one day I'm going to be happy. So I practiced for 20 years, and I wonder why, in some ways, life doesn't actually seem to get any easier. Am I happier? You know, am I happier? So at this point, I've sort of got to stop you getting up and leaving the room because somebody's suggesting that what you came shopping for here isn't actually available. And I'm assuming that, like me, you came for things like inner peace and contentment, ceasing of mind chatter, and the odd bit of cake and herbal tea. And then, of course, the next thing I've got to say is that, of course, it is available. And the proof, if you like, is very much here to see. I don't think any of us would keep coming back unless we saw frequently the products of Buddhist practice, of which spiritual death is absolutely key and central. So, of all the people in our Sangha, the ones I've met, the ones I've heard, of all of the ones that I really admire and I kind of aspire to be like, number one, they do seem happy, in inverted commas. But I think that these people, what they have in common is that they have kept in touch with something quite radical in their lives. I think that this radical spirit is expressed in three ways. Firstly, these people that I know and admire are willing to live lightly. They're willing to live free, or much freer, of things like material things, of expectations, of aspirations, and of fixed views. The second thing is that they seem to have a remarkable energy and a kind of psychic aliveness to them that I love to be around. And thirdly, they are always altruistic, or they aspire to be altruistic, loving and compassionate. And they are forgiving and kind people who are very easy to be with. Now, to a greater or lesser extent, I see these qualities embodied throughout the Sangha, right from the person who's just walked through the door for the first time, right through to Bante Sangharakshita himself, you know, the founder of the movement, and way beyond. But what makes them different, I think, is that they've embraced spiritual death. They've let go of a lot of that view that they can fix things, that they can, if they do things differently, they'll be okay. And they've turned more and more towards accepting things as they really are, as they experience them, with all the discomfort, with all the suffering that that brings, alongside the pleasures of life as well, which they're well able to enjoy, but maybe to they let those go more easily. In other words, they've let go of trying to make it different more, and they've let themselves into their actual experience with all its difficulty and challenge more. That's the difference. So the term spiritual death is a metaphor. The journey leads not to a place of loss and lack, as perhaps is suggested by the word death, or the notion of death for us, but to a superabundance and an endless plenitude, a rich place. That's what they've got. For them, self is not a separately existing thing that needs to be renounced. Spiritual death is pointing to the need to see through our view of a really fixed existing self that's separate from all else. You know, another thing about these people is they live in incredible connection, both with their friends, with their world. There's this real sense that they're part of the flow of existence. Now, I think this is a really good attempt to define a spiritual death, but I just want to say that I think with spiritual death, we need not to be too literal or too conceptual about it. It's quite a sort of chunky term, spiritual death, and we all of us have a lot of associations with the word death. So in trying to sort of learn it, to know it, I think we need not to be too intellectual, too conceptual. We need not to be too eager or too anxious to get anything here. It's better to feel our way into it, I think. Here's another attempt at defining spiritual death, which might be helpful for us. This is not mine, this is somebody else's, and I'm quoting. So, essentially, spiritual death is about letting go, or going beyond a fixed sense of self, letting go into the present moment, investigating our experience there, and discovering that it's constantly changing. It's empty of anything whatsoever that is fixed and unchanging, including a sense of self. We hear this again and again and again and again. And the thing is that we need to hear it again and again and again and again, because it's such a big one to take in, to absorb, to begin to fully believe. And the corollary of understanding that everything is impermanent and in a constant flux of change is that we have to apply that realization to ourselves, and we have to really accept it. I have to accept that there isn't a fixed Suryodaya who needs to be liked or respected or asserted or protected or admired or apologized to or anything else, which I spend a very great deal of my life trying to sort of set up, asserting that self of me. But actually, all I am is a constantly changing flux of conditions that I identify as Suryodaya. I'm not the same as I was yesterday. I won't be the same tomorrow. I will wither and die soon, very soon, just like the flowers on the shrine. In other words, there's nothing fixed to control, to maintain, to keep the same, or to aspire to stay secure about and comfortable with. So that brings me on kind of to the subject of fear in all its forms, ranging through from acute fear, terror, right through to the anxiety, mild or quite severe, which many of us experience as a sort of a rolling thing in our lives. That's fear. Most of us are frightened of the notion of not being in control, and in a sense, death is the ultimate loss of control. I mean, as I said, who wants to die? And my answer to that actually now is, well, actually, I do. I want to die. I want to die not out of existence, but I want to die out of the way that I habitually experience myself. I'm fed up with it. I once heard someone talking about suicide in a very enlightening way, with a wonderful lightness and a very great wisdom. And she said to me, yes, of course, she said, you could see suicide actually is just a longing to be free of samsara. It's not that you want to annihilate yourself and, you know, create havoc and cause all that destruction. It's simply that you want to stop the pain of being that habitual self. You want something different. You instinctively know that there's another possible way of being and you have a longing for it. And at that particular time in my life, it was just such a great relief to hear that. Oh, it's okay, you know, that makes sense of some of my experience. So the core spiritual problem is that we can accept the truth, is can we accept the truth of impermanence and insubstantiality? If everything is changing, then so am I. And if that's the case, then how do I make sense of my life? And is the inevitability of sickness, old age and death a terror, or is it a gateway for freedom? I mean, it's arguable that for my friends, where they were that evening, it was still a terror. They weren't kind of going there with it. But for me, I hope that potentially it's a doorway, it's a path. I think if we accept that most of us feel great fear in our lives from time to time about things like loss, about pain and illness, about discomfort and fear of the unknown, all things strongly associated with death, then perhaps it's helpful to think more about how we meet fear. And I think a lot of us have done this. What is fearlessness? I mean, that's, I think it's a really good question to ask ourselves. Is fearlessness an absence of fear, or is it the willingness to face it? And anyway, what's useful for me, for myself, there's no way I'm ever going to be fear-free, but perhaps the better path is to cultivate a willingness to sort of really look it in the eye, to meet your demons. And as Badra explained so incredibly powerfully and very well, and very movingly, I thought, last week, to fold everything into our experience, all the great and the good and the lovely bits, and all the difficulties and all the challenges and all the dark parts. It was really great in our women's group when we were doing this, you were doing this thing, weren't you, with this sort of figure of eight movement about, maybe you weren't aware that you were doing it, but... In our women's group afterwards, they completely got it. Everybody was talking about cooking. You know, we had meringues and making dough. And that kind of followed on to some really, really wonderful examples of people's experience. I quite like that metaphor of cooking our way through. Now, going back to this control thing, I came across something really interesting in my preparation for this talk. And I was reading a talk on spiritual death by an order member called Vidya Mala, who many of you will have heard of, because she's one of the founders of the Breathworks Mindfulness for Stress and Pain Management courses, which have ballooned and blossomed and become so successful. She is herself somebody who's in permanent pain physically, and she's learned this fantastic way of dealing with it. I admire her very much. And she's saying in this talk that meditation is the working ground for working with fear, for facing fear, and for letting go of the contractions and the barriers we experience around it. She often talks about boiling our practice down to two simple things, which I think is an incredibly powerful thing and one really worth repeating. She says, in any one moment, notice where you are. Are you contracted or are you open? Where are you now? Are you contracted or are you open? This is spiritual death. This is not spiritual death. Mm-hmm. Now, she says that in her work with people who are experiencing chronic pain, she's found time and again that this particular group of people are incredibly receptive to what she's trying to teach. This turning towards instead of turning away. She says that by the time they book themselves onto her retreats, they're tired of running away. They've seen the futility of trying to avoid experience over and over again. They are an extremely courageous and very highly motivated group of people who are willing to turn around, look the demon in the eye, and try to make peace with their experience. This is what she says. Spiritual death is a large part of their path, both in terms of loss and also potential liberation. She says, and I quote, "We put it quite bluntly to them that the option of turning back the clock to their pre-accident, pre-illness, or self simply doesn't exist. And this means that they have two options. One is to be in pain and to be miserable, and two is to be in pain but with a sense of control." Putting it another way, she says, "Pain is inevitable, misery is a choice." I don't want to sort of sound too gloomy and doomy about this, but I think it is actually helpful to look at this particular group of people. I think it's got a lot to teach us. You know, for myself, I don't suffer from persistent pain, mental or physical. And when I do suffer from discomfort, from dukkha in my life, there's a whole bunch of anesthetics that I can turn to and frequently do. You know, the usual things, the telly, the movie, the Nurofen, the alcohol and all the rest of it. But I think it's really worth reminding ourselves that they can get in the way of us really turning towards the truth of dukkha. We can make ourselves comfortable quite easily with relatively minor states of suffering. But I think there's a danger that we can get sidetracked in the spiritual life with this. I think people can settle down at the level of integration. If you're lucky enough to have worked effectively with integration and then with the cultivation of positive emotion, to get to a state where you feel happy and healthy and human and better and balanced, you can actually kind of ossify instead of opening up further to the next step of really taking this stuff on board. You can kind of settle down into a sort of stuckness. I haven't seen this very frequently, but I've definitely seen it. I mean, in one way, part of me is sort of thinking, well, I wish, you know, I'd got to the state of, you know, positive emotion and integration. I'm still very much at those stages. Although when I was writing that, I was thinking, well, come on, Surya Dyer. No, you've got a spiritual death practice, very much so. I think my friends would say that. you know, as it's worth reminding ourselves with this whole mandala of practice, the system of practice, these things, we don't go through these things in a linear way. We're working with all of them simultaneously. You know, while we're working with integration, there will be aspects of the spiritual death that arise. We need to remember that, this sort of circular thing. Anyway, this brings me on to the next point, which is actually, again, going back to this whole subject of control. What can we actually do? How can we practice with this? And also this central paradox, which I've struggled with from time to time. I mean, here's Surya Dyer telling me that there's no fixed me to control. So if I can't control anything, then how do I change anything? How do I transform myself? And isn't everything just inevitable? Well, the answer is, of course, no. Although we can't control any fixed thing, we can actually control our flow of experience to some degree. And we have to work, it's important to understand that we have to work with who we are in samsara. We're not enlightened beings. We have to sort of hold these two things, the knowledge of shunyata and also at the same time the experience of being a very solid me simultaneously. Now, the core Buddhist teaching which is relevant in this regard is conditionality, the understanding that everything arises in dependence on conditions. And that is what my flow of experience is. It's just an endless arising and falling away of conditions. In a sense, the flow of me is an endless arising and a falling away of conditions. Now, we've all learned about conditionality, and we've heard about the trees having apples and blah, 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 blah. But this central core realization of the Buddha at enlightenment, But there's a range of teachings around conditionality that delve into this much further and I think are incredibly helpful, which you may or you may not have come across. So some of you have learned about them, and they're called the niyamas, or niyamas. Or a translation that would be the sort of the laws of nature, the laws of the universe, the laws of conditionality operating in the universe. And they tell us about what we can and we can't control in our lives. They also explain a lot of the misunderstandings about karma that you come across when you sort of say to yourself, say to your friends, oh, I've become Buddhist. They say, oh, karma, I know about that. You know, if you do bad things, you die. They're very sort of simplistic interpretations. So the niyamas are actually five different levels of conditionality operating in our lives. And some of them we can control, and some of them we absolutely can't. We've got no control over them whatsoever. And these are the ones at the bottom. So I'm just going to go through them just relatively briefly. Really recommend that you take it up and read more extensively about it. But starting at the bottom, there's what's known as the Uttu Niyama, or these are inorganic laws. And these basically correspond to the whole world of physics and chemistry. These are the laws of gravity, of thermodynamics, where again and again we witness, cause, result, condition, result, consequences, structure of atoms, so forth, earthquakes, hurricanes, subsidence, erosion, things beyond our control. I might be the nicest person in the universe and do all the right things and be spiritually super superior, but if a rock falls on my head because somebody hasn't, I'm going to die. The next level is what's called the Bija Niyama. And these are the organic laws. And this is the world of biology and of organic living systems. It includes things like botany, physiology, the laws, infection, symbiosis. In a way, whatever we think about them, the plant and the animal kingdom behave in ways which we can largely predict. The third level, things getting a little bit more esoteric now, is the Mano Niyama, and this is kind of the workings of basic psychology, autonomic psychology. It's the workings of perception, of instinct, of things like our inbuilt fight or flight reactions. I mean, a good example would be the homing instinct of birds, for example, or our very, very deep instinct to protect our young. These are almost we're programmed to behave like this. It's almost automatic. It's not a world of control. These are our automatic responses. So these niyamas are, in a sense, largely the provinces of sciences, but they also affect our spiritual journey. For example, in our course towards integration and to emotional positivity, a lot of that is concerned with taking ownership of things like our genetic inheritance, our nature and our nurture. We do need to discover the kind of person that we are and to find a fruitful way of making use of that. It's important to remember that we do arrive in life with a whole bunch of givens, and that all of us need to work with that before we can progress further. But according to Buddhism, there are two more natural processes at work in the universe, and these also govern human and spiritual life. And these are called the karma and the dharma niyamas, these sort of levels. So the karma niyama only comes into play with reflexive self-consciousness, which arguably is only available in humans. It's the relationship between a self-conscious subject, us, and its experience. But this is the land of choice. This is the land of the gap that we've all learned about. This is the land of reactivity and creativity. This is where there is control. Trained in meditation and ethics and wisdom, we can begin to exercise choice in how we respond both to adversity and also to pleasure, both of them. We begin to learn that if we act on the basis of goodwill and positivity, then life feels as if it's going somewhere. And that if we act from stress and irritability, jealousy, comparison, blah, 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 then we kind of go round in circles. Those lines, the karma I create shapes the course of my life, but however I act, life always has difficulties. No one can control it all. That's what I have to learn to accept. So once we're working effectively with our karma processes, then we begin to leave our attachment to ourselves behind. And then the Dharma Niyama process come into play. This is the sort of fifth level. This is largely what Badger was talking about, a lot of what Badger was talking about last week. Usually we're so locked into being me that we don't notice the pull of something beyond, of the big beyond. It's the something bigger. You remember he asked us if we'd had the experience of something bigger. And this something bigger isn't an existing God, another existing God, or any kind of force. But it's what we feel, what we sense, what we know when something else comes through. When we're listening to great music or watching transporting dance or seeing the art or beauty or, you know, these kind of big experiences that sort of erupt through our lives and send us into a different zone that make the frame of our existence suddenly go ping out to a huge frame and not a small one. It's the moments when we get ourselves out of the way of our experience, I think, and we experience a fuller perception of things and life as it is, and a much richer truth. And I remember when I was getting ordained, and they kept saying to me in my feedbacks, she's getting herself out of her way more, I think. And I used to think, what on earth are they talking about? She's getting herself, how could I possibly in my way be in my own way? You know, didn't get it at all. I heard it again and again. I don't think I ever actually asked anybody what the hell they meant by she's getting herself out of her own way. I think now I understand it much, much more. Because I think what it is, it's as if we're standing in this cave and there's this sunlit world outside that we can sense, and we're looking out at it, but there's this big shadow between us and the sunlit world. And it's ours, it's our shadow, but we just don't realise that it's our own shadow, you know. So it's one way of thinking about it, in sort of visual terms. Anyway, Badger came up with a very good quote for me about this last week when we were talking. And he said, it's all about understanding the distinction between taking control of our lives and taking responsibility for our conditions. The first thing, arguably, we can't. The second thing, we most certainly can. So that's it. Not bad. Our question tonight for our groups, what parts of samsara would you like to fix? Do you think you can? What parts of samsara would you like to fix, and do you think you can? Okay, and we've got 20 minutes to have a chat about it.